Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires we call the interwebs is Joe Crazy Writer. How you doing this week, Joe?
I just want to know, if women are so bloody perfect at multitasking, how come they can't have a headache and sex at the same time?
What's up with that? Breaking out the crickets right out of the
gate. Just got to make sure they're still alive. It's been a weird winter, and just want to make sure you haven't accidentally put them in your lentil soup and thought they were just crunchy bits.
No, the crickets are fine.
Now, I got a question, Corey.
Okay.
What city do you live in?
Well, I live in Deep 13.
Okay. And I happen to know that's Chaska, Minnesota. But did you know who Chaska is named after?
Robert Chaska.
Close. It's actually named after Wee Chaska Watadompi, or Chaske. He died December 26, 1862, and was a Native American.
Wait a minute. He died?
He died. He was a Native American of the Dakotas. Sick. He was executed in a mass hanging near Mankato, Minnesota, in the wake of the Dakota War of 1862, despite the fact that President Lincoln commuted his death sentence days earlier. After the war shaped up, not a lot of people know about this war because it was, right when the Civil War broke up, but there was a big war in Minnesota between the Dakota Native Americans and the white settlers. And
It carries on to this day with those of us hating North Dakota.
It is, because that's where they ended up. Once we, the white man, won the war, we exiled all the Dakotas to the Dakotas. But before they did that, they were going to hang 138 of them. And Lincoln actually pardoned a bunch. But 38 ended up being hung. And unfortunately, Chaska was hung because of a case of mistaken identity. And the sad thing about it, he actually helped hide some of the white people from the Dakota warriors. So in typical white man fashion, we named a city after him.
Well, that was nice.
It was. Now you know, because knowledge is power.
And now you know the rest of the story.
Oh, they're still going on. It's like the 150th anniversary, and there's a move to pardon him. And it's kind of like some people are like, yeah, that's a good idea. And some of them are like, no, all it would do is ease white man guilt. And, some of the Dakota leaders are like, shine a light on it and let people know about the history here. I mean, a lot of people don't even realize there was a lynching. I'm not talking about the Deep South. I'm talking north of us up in Duluth. But we'll save that for another time.
And that's why I don't go to Duluth.
Oh, it's fine now. A little cold. They might even have a comic book store there.
Speaking of comic book stores,
which we like to,
Joe and I went to an Irish wake last Saturday.
Yes.
With real Irish music.
And real Irish people.
Yes. We went to Dreamhaven for their, I'm going to call it a closing because they're only going to be open by appointment or for special things or for mail order.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Greg Ketter, a damn handsome man.
Fine handsome. You can actually find him on Facebook too.
Yes.
Because as part of our Facebook thing, I actually put a liking on him. So
if you put a liking on him.
Yeah, we do.
Does your wife know about that?
Well, of course. He's a damn handsome man.
There you go. So Joe was going to punk out on me till I guilted him.
I wasn't punked out. It was puked out.
See, that's what happens when you keep those death mates all over the place.
I gotta learn just not to eat.
Yeah, I'm getting ready to go and I get a text from Joe. I'm not gonna make it. Yep. All I could think is that the thousands and thousands of listeners were all going to be disappointed.
Yeah. Not that anybody actually came up and said hi to me when I was there, but that's a different story.
Well, those were people who knew you.
That's true. And then my daughter tagged along Dana because she was sure Neil Gaiman would show up.
Although he was out of the country.
I told her, I said, what you got to do is look online and see where his blog says he is. I mean, Neil's been known to just drop in on Greg every so often whenever he's in town and sign a bunch of his books. Matter of fact, if you ever want an autographed book by Neil Gaiman, Greg's the place to go. Because I swear almost every book I saw had his autograph. I did see one book, though. The one thing about Dreamhaven, and it's sad it won't be open as a regular store anymore. And it's always been this way, no matter what store, and we've talked about it at previous podcasts. You could walk through the store, and you're going to find stuff that you just never saw before. And you could walk through the store, I swear, daily, and you'd still find things like, was this here yesterday? I even pointed it out to you. I mean, I looked up, and there was a beam across the ceiling where Greg yes. had strategically placed different items for sale. Never saw it.
Same here.
It's the first time. I did see one thing, though, that had me scurrying home, and I talked to Corey about it. He had two copies of Good Omen. That's a book by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett that allegedly is being made into a movie. And one of them must have been like an artist proof or something because Greg had it. It was signed by both Neil and Terry Pratchett, and it was like $700. But it looked different. I'd never seen something like that. He also had a first print that was signed by both of them that he was asking about $300 for. So I ran home and scurried and checked out my copy, which I guess I picked up at a signing at Dreamhaven when Neil and Terry were there. And I do indeed have a first print. I do indeed have them both signed. And I thought I'd share with you what Neil and Terry wrote on here.
Okay.
Neil writes, for Joe, reading this book will send you straight to hell. And Terry goes, see you, we'll be in the pool. And no, I'm not selling it.
There's something you're not selling?
Well, I got to read it first. I read like half of it, and for whatever reason, I just set it aside and never finished it.
Now, Joe was worried because I said that there would probably be music, that there was no place to set up. What Greg did is he kind of cleared out some stuff in the middle of the store, put up chairs and a table for the food and the drink. And there was a guy there with a mandolin and a guitar who played Irish songs. Every song was about pain and death and suffering and famine. And
yes,
none of the songs had a happy ending.
But with typical mandolin music, just like a banjo, it was happy sounding.
Yes.
Because you just can't play a depressing song on a mandolin.
What I thought was hilarious is here he is. He's singing a song actually about the potato famine. And a woman had a small child, probably between 1 and 2, who was happily clapping along. The irony was not lost on me.
Well, that's good. So, because your shirt was kind of wrinkled. I'm glad you used some irony on it.
Crickets again, ladies and gentlemen.
The yeah, you're pretty liberal with them crickets when you want to be. So what did you buy anything that day?
I bought a grocery bag full of used books.
Cool.
I just kept going back and going, you know, I might want to read. It was one of those where all used books were a dollar. So it's, oh, look, he's got best science fiction short stories from like 1974 to 1988. You know what? Boom, there's a good month's worth of reading at the overnight shifts. And he had this big stack of Galaxy magazines from the 50s. And they were 50 cents each. So I bought one. I bought the ones that didn't have continued stories in them.
Cool.
Just because science fiction magazines of the 50s, for a lot of people who don't know a lot about the history of science fiction, it was really hard to get a science fiction book published up until the late 50s, early 60s, because the magazines were where all the sales were. And there were very few novels. Actually, most of the novels until the, well, until Harlan Ellison's Dangerous Visions book were serialized in the magazines, and then they would just put out a collected version as a book. And it was pretty rare for science fiction to be in hardcover until the 70s when the book publishers went, hey, these books actually sell, and we're learning that science fiction geeks have a lot of money, so let's publish these as hardcovers. So most of the science fiction up until the 60s was in magazine form. And then it would be reprinted in books. Kind of like how comics are printed in monthly form and then collected in books. See, I can always bring it back to comics.
Always. It's always a turnaround.
Yeah.
I picked up a used copy of The Crow, James O'Barr.
Yes.
Because I don't have a copy anymore. But I sold my first editions and I sold the books. And, you know, this is the one that the special editions where he went in and tinkered with it, added things that he had to cut out because he had to keep it within, 23 or 26 pages, the original comic. And he said there were things that he wasn't at that time skilled enough to pull off that he did. And there were things he had to drop because he had to keep them within the confines of a comic. So I remember reading it originally and it was damn depressing, but I can't wait to dig into it again.
It's still damn depressing.
I'll rip up some of the mandolin music and just let it play in the background.
There you go. The other thing I always found interesting about James O'Barr and The Crow, this thing burst out and was crazy popular. I read Brian Michael Bendis, who worked, his early stuff was at Caliber. He said that Caliber kind of rode on the profits of those early issues of The Crow. It sold so well that they were able to kind of finance their operations for a while. Then it went over to Kitchen Sink. And then when Kitchen Sink went away, but James O'Barr has not really had any success after The Crow, which surprises me because his art is really good. His storytelling in that was very powerful. And I know that he has depression issues, which really come through in his art. But I thought for sure that he was one of those guys that we'd see more of, and we really haven't.
No, I think he was at the con once.
Yeah, and they kept him in a separate area.
Well, allegedly he had people who invited him were there to handle him so that he wouldn't go off.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And I do recall something interesting when the original education building, when the MCBA would set up their two-day con, not the big grandstand that the MCBA Spring Con Comic Book Celebration will be at this May 19th and 20th, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's in the Minnesota State Fairground. I mean, the grandstand's huge. The education building had these display cabinets that lined one side of the hall, and you could lock the door, basically like pegboard, and you could set things up. And during the fair, you would set up different displays. That would be where, for example, my daughter did a thing on Minnesota, her whole class, everybody picked the state, did a display. The best of them went on to the state fair, got judged, yada, yada, yada. They were put into these displays. What the MCBA did is if you had artwork or something you wanted to show off, sculptures, whatever, you could just let the MCBA know and set up, and they would be put in these glass display cases. Joe Fingvall would bring a lot of his Wonder Woman art. The year James O'Barr came to the con, I set up my Matchbox cars. And I had a lot of cars, a lot of them tied into TV shows. I had oodles of Batmobiles. Excuse me. Corgi had that Superman mobile from, just like from the comic book, if you remember that back in the old actions. And anyways, I set this up. Some were loose, some were in the package. Anyway, James O'Barr was just looking at the display. I happened to be the one watching the whole glass enclosures, make sure nobody went in there. The one car he commented on was a car from a James Dean movie. You know, and it was one of those movies where he just made the comment, oh, that's the car he died in. And I was like, so I actually got it, you know, and that was like one of the more positive things he said at the entire con. But, you know, because he just kind of wandered away. But, I mean, he was a good guest. He posed with the belt. Back then, I was taking pictures of our guests wearing the belt and take a Polaroid and get a sign. I'll dig those up sometime and put them in an album, share them like I did some of the artwork I have on it. And you can always access it through the official Crazy Comics and Stuff podcast page, which has not gone timeline yet, but it's on Facebook. And from there, you can bump into my page and look through my photo albums. I got them wide open. Wide open. We did see Nick from The Source.
Yep.
Pat and Brian as well, two of the guys working the MCBA. I didn't see anybody else. I mean, I there were a couple of guys who, you know, shopped at my store. Greg, Lars, I can't remember his last name. You run into anybody while you were there?
I didn't run into anybody I know, but I had some really good conversations with people. There was a gentleman there with his sister. They were talking about the San Diego Comic Con and they've been going for like 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And they were, you know, very worried that they might not be able to get tickets this year.
Yeah, it's going to be crazy. If you're not right on it the day they sell them, you're out.
Yeah. A lot of people who were there who didn't know anything at all about comics. They were just there for the books.
Mm-hmm.
Got Dana, some recommendations.
Dana ran through and picked up a bunch of $1 items that Greg had, like, back in his clearance section.
Yep.
And I looked at him and go, cool, show me where that was. She ended up buying a bunch more. There was one thing I saw that I might have to call Greg and see if he'll sell it to me, because you can now get a hold of him. Like I say, he's got a Dreamhaven page. He's got it's dreamhaven.com on the web, because he'll do mail order. But he had a book called The Daleks from the Doctor Who sometime in the 60s. Just one of those, you know, thin trade paperbacks. You know, I imagine it's probably a Ballantine novel or maybe whoever was back then. It looked kind of interesting. But being I dropped a huge bundle at Hot Comics in New Hope, I ran over there with my comic book price guide and just happened to, I filled in my Superman family run. I filled
Ooh.
In the second Doctor Strange series. And I think the first one, except I don't have number 3, which I believe was a reprint anyways. So it was and a few more of the on my quest to fill in every book of the Ultraverse. So I'd spent a lot of money the night before. So I poked around Greg's and I saw a few things and saw a lot of things. If I was, you know, at the upper 1%, I probably would have bought more. That's hell being on the bottom.
Well, I've been reading too. I've been reading on my overnights. First off, I have now watched all 4 seasons of Mad Men.
Awesome.
And
now the question I have, were you watching Mad Men or just watching Christine?
I was watching Mad Men.
Okay, just checking. I know you.
I'm deeply in love with Christina Hendricks now. Not just the actress, too. Her character is very interesting. I love the show. I got hooked on the show. And one thing about the DVDs that I'm enjoying at home, there's at least one commentary for every episode, and some of them have 2 or 3 commentaries. So I've been, you know, putting it on if I'm cooking or something or cleaning. I put on and just listen to the commentary because I already know the episode. I was listening to one, the actress who plays Peggy did the commentary. And first off, I had no idea that she was also President Bartlett's daughter on The West Wing.
Mm.
But her commentary was one of those. I love DVD commentaries. I really do.
I do too.
there are some where they get too involved in watching the show and quit talking. And because it was just her, there would be like 3 and 5 minute gaps where, you know, she'd say something and then it would just be silent. And the first time it was, oh, I'm maybe the cat stepped on the remote and it's no longer doing the commentary. No, it's still doing the commentary. She's just not talking. So that might take us right into freaking and geeking.
Mm-hmm.
Geeking and Freaking is brought to us by Bart Kopp at bartkopp.com. It's a political humor website, and he's really been on a roll with the Republican primaries. So if you're like me and you think the Republican primaries are pretty darn funny, go over to bartkopp.com. Here's his ad.
Hi, my name's Bart, and I got a little radio show over at bartkopp.com that we call it the Tequila Treehouse. And on the radio show, we talk about a lot of things. You know, we talk about sports, and we talk about sex, and we talk about TV, and we talk about movies. But really, we're not talking about those things. We're usually talking about the politics of the sports and the sex and the TV and the movies and that. So if you go to bartkopp.com, you might get to hear a sample. Actually, the radio show is for the subscribers, but now and then we open it up to the general masses, or we play some snippets on there trying to tease you into subscribing. But that's over at bartkopp.com, the Tequila Treehouse. Try it. You might like it.
So, Joe, geeking. I'm geeking about what AMC's got coming up. They've got next Sunday, they start Walking Dead again, followed by the new Kevin Smith series called Comic Book Men, which is a reality show set in a comic book shop, the one that Kevin Smith owns. And then in March is the return of Mad Men. I am also really geeking about the current story in Amazing Spider-Man. I've read the first part. And have you read it, Joe?
I think I did. Let me look at my pile of books here.
I'll just give you the setup. Peter Parker works at a lab, and one of his lab partners says, hey, you got to see this new invention. It's a doorway, and when you step through it, you go one day into the future.
Matter of fact, I have the conclusion of that right here because it came out this week.
Well, don't tell me because I don't have it.
Okay, I haven't read it yet. So
so the guy who invents it steps through, grabs a newspaper, brings it back. Peter Parker steps through, and New York is completely destroyed. Utterly destroyed. So he steps back through, and the reason is, you know, when you step into the future, well, you've been gone for a day. So something happened. Spider-Man prevented something that destroyed all of New York. So now he's got to find out what it is. And it's just a wonderful little time travel story. A lot of good Spider-Man action, a lot of characterization. It's the kind of stuff that I read Spider-Man for. So that's what I'm geeking about. Joe?
I'm geeking on giveaway comic books. Just recently, it's been an ongoing thing, but I've been slowly trying to get my comic books in my comic book checklist and price guide so that when I run out to different stores, like yesterday I ran out to one of the local Half-Price bookstores and picked up some comics. And I found a few Ultraverse, and I took a chance that I didn't have it. And in this case, it was Mantra number 5, when they revamped all the books, went them to $150 instead of $299. And, you know, I didn't have it, so I lucked out. I mean, sometimes I buy the books so cheap I don't care. But other times, you know, it's kind of annoying to spend that much money on something only to find out you have it. But like I said, I've been looking at some of the books that they've been given away. For example, if how many did you have a Radio Shack around town, Corey, when you were growing up?
Yeah, but I didn't go in there because it was always kind of empty and creepy and.
Well, if you went in, you could have gotten the free comics. They were always Whiz Kids, Dandy Computer Whiz Kids, and there's various of them. I have no idea how many they made, but it's like they're always compliments of Radio Shack, a division of Dandy Corporation. Like this one here. Catalog number 68, 2010, The Answer to a Riddle. And then this one, 2015, Safeguarding the Environment. There's even a few where Superman were involved in. So I've been picking these up. I mentioned Half Price. They had this thing called Navy History and Tradition. And it's Naval Actions of the Civil War. That was a giveaway. And it actually has a an address of the U.S. Navy something. Somebody stamped their code on it. Sometimes there are things like a couple of years ago, Toys R Us had a special replica edition of Detective Comics. And you get this three-pack. It was a Detective number 38, First Robin, Detective number 359, the first Batgirl. And let me open up my three-pack. I think the first Mr. Freeze from 121. One of them I got was something that was given away at the Warner Brothers store. Superman Adventures number 1 sneak preview. Must have been something advertising either the TV show or the comic. There are the Marvel newspaper editions. I picked up a Firestar, Spider-Man, Firestar, and Iceman at the Dallas Ballet Nutcracker.
Wow.
Dallas Time feature.
Well, good. Well, what did Iceman think of the ballet?
I didn't say I'm reading them. I'm just picking them up.
Oh.
A couple of them, like here's American Legion, Our Country's Flag, with a nice patriotic people saluting or got their hand over their heart. This is a fairly new one I picked up. It's the Marvel and the Fantastic Four in Brain Drain that was given away at Office Max Teachers Count. This was 2006. It also featured Office Max Superhero Teachers of the Year. I've got oodles of these things in my collection. And, you know, and not to mention the free comic book day things. I'm trying to get them all organized just to see what they are. I've actually been finding a lot of them on eBay, too. I just picked up, I don't remember what the deal was. It was a Superman contest giveaway back when Byrne was revamping Superman and Man of Steel. And you could win issues 1 through 6, but they were in a black and white format. They made only 6,000 of them. 3,000 were given to fans, 3,000 is given to dealers. And you had to win it unless the dealer sold you his. So I've only ever seen one before, and I believe my old partner Gruber had it. And somebody had it on eBay. So I picked it up. eBay's making me broke. I swear, I just typed in giveaway and like 1,000 comics come up and I'm like, there's one I'll probably buy. I think the guy's just offering it for sale. It was a, let's see if I can find it here quick. It's the, from American Airlines, and it's got, I guess they called it Astro Comics, American Airline giveaway. And it has Wendy the Good Witch, Casper, Spooky, Richie Rich, Hot Devil, you know. So your favorite comic book characters to enjoy on your Astrojet flight.
Oh.
So.
Well, and what are you freaking about? What are you unhappy about? What are you going, we're in trouble.
I keep losing on eBay. And it's not by a lot. It's always by like $2 or less. Makes me mad.
Well, it's just proving you're a cheap bastard.
Well, yeah, it's been noticed. But other than that, you know, I just, to me, it's more of a philosophical thing. I just don't have time to do everything I want to do with the comics. So I want to get them organized. I want to get them straightened out. I just don't have time to do it, you know? And it's just, even just trying to finish my long-term quest of Ultraverse is, you know, it's not really the money thing, because everything I'm after is cheap anyways. I'm not looking to buy, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollar comic books and stuff. You know, I'm happy with cheap ones. You know, like I said, I was at Half Price Books and I picked up two Babylon 5 comics for 50 cents. You know, they're just blowing them out. I'm like, hey, that's good enough for me. Good reading at 50 cents. I just hope I keep this mood when the con comes around, because they always have a lot of cheap comics. And sometimes I get to the con, I'm like, I don't feel like getting on my knees and digging through comics with everybody else.
I just hope that this latest job search is over before the con so I can spend some money.
Yeah. It's been a while since we've got a geek day going.
Yep. All right. Here's what I'm freaking about. And we might as well just put through our last couple of sponsors.
Sure.
Because I have a feeling that this might create a debate. This show is hosted on DreamHost.com, the best damn web host in the known universe. DreamHost.com has been the host of my website and the Solitaire Rose family of websites since 1999. And I very, very few problems. Anytime there's a problem, I contact them. It's fixed immediately. They have some of the lowest prices for hosting. And they're not a bunch of scum weasels like those bastards at GoDaddy. So DreamHost.com, head on over there. If you use the code CRAZ, you get $20 off your first year.
If you happen to be a bastard at GoDaddy and want to think you can one-up, feel free to try. Feel free. Not going to happen.
Yeah, they've had a lot of trouble the last year or so. I don't even think they're going to have a Super Bowl ad this year.
Darn.
Usually their Super Bowl ads are continued on the web, and they promise nudity and never give it to you.
Although there is a new, apparently there's a 20-second Avenger teaser, so it's on YouTube already if you want to check it out.
The only ad that I've seen already that I like is the Matthew Broderick ad.
Yeah, and I did find, I'm assuming I watched the whole thing.
Now, the sponsor for Tales from the Shop is Broomhilda Music at broomhildamusic.com. That's Chris B., who's moving.
What?
Yep, she is moving to Portland, Oregon. So
when Mount Rainier blows up, she'll have a better chance of being eliminated. Good for her. That's
or, you know, she could sing. She could sing at whatever's left.
True.
It might eliminate the competition. So just go to her website at broomhildamusic.com. You can order the CD. It was you. And if you tell her, no, the name of it is It Was You.
It was me. She named a CD after me.
Why do I feel like I'm trapped in an Abbott Costello routine?
I'm flattered, but, you know, I would have liked a free copy. I mean,
she also did the theme for Tales from the Shop. Even though there isn't a Tales from the Shop this time, we're going to have an extra special Tales from the Shop next time. We're doing the Water Gun Wars, right?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. So here's the theme. And here's what I'm freaking about. The internet has been cleaved in half.
Is this about the Republican debates again?
No, it's about a stronger debate with more passion on both sides.
Oh, you're talking about
far more work
the legendary theater professor Arthur Ballett passed away at 87. He was for 25 years, he lectured at the University of Minnesota. And if you wanted to do a intro to theater class, he was great. And what was cool is he was on like KSDP, one of the local channels here, reviewing movies. And the first thing he would do is when the class starts, is he would say, now basically it was like in a theater. So he's on stage. He's probably got, you know, 400 kids in class, you know. So I want you to know there's one reason why I'm reviewing movies on KSDP. Money. I don't want to ask any other questions about this the rest of the quarter. Did you know I got sick in his class? There was a morning.
Were you reading Death Mate?
Nauseous. And I went to class anyways because it was college, you know. And he was on stage. He was telling a story. I don't know if it was Othello or what, but the warrior was coming home from battle. And there was a great feast laid out for him by his wife. And, So I'm in the audience thinking, oh, I'm not going to get sick. I'm not going to get sick. And he's up there and he says, woman, as the guy cuts his teeth into a big mullet. Where's my father? And here's me in the audience going, I'm not going to get sick. I'm not going to get sick. And the wife says, you're eating him. And I'm in the audience going, oh, I'm going to be sick. I'm going to be sick. And I fled the theater and promptly threw up. And then I went home because apparently I was catching the flu at the time. But I don't think I've ever thrown up in college before.
Well, that's because you went to college before Deathmate came out. He's gonna puke. He's gonna puke. No, this is the biggest controversy to hit the internet in since the beginning of the internet, Joe.
Oh, the five lost photos that could have changed history?
Nope.
Castle Age not loading last night?
Nope.
Oh, I'm out.
Before Watchmen.
What do you mean before Watchmen?
That's what DC's calling the new, however many, six, seven miniseries. Before Watchmen. They're doing prequels to Watchmen.
Cool.
Meh. I could not possibly care less.
And why might that be?
Well, first off, Watchmen was a complete story with a beginning, middle, and an end. We learned everything we needed to know about the characters in it. And the people who are doing the prequels aren't remotely connected to Alan Moore or Dave Gibbons. So much like the TV prequel to Casablanca, I figure if I ignore it long enough, it'll go away.
I don't think it really matters. Because
that's why I'm not going to buy it. It doesn't matter.
No, I mean the internet chatter doesn't matter.
No, DC's desperate for money because the 52 haze is already starting to drop.
Oh, geez, a corporation desperate for money. There's a shocker. I don't really think it matters because DC's been after Moore for years to do something, anything. And Moore's always said, no, no, no. And the prevailing wisdom is, as we talked about, because the deal Moore struck is that as soon as Watchmen went out of print, like everything.
Actually,
did,
I have dug back. I have all sorts of facts on the Watchmen contract.
But the prevailing wisdom was that once it went out of print, and it was the same with V for Vendetta, Moore would get it back. And it never has, never was. Moore was upset about that. He was upset about merchandising stuff that was being called promotional items, whatever. What I didn't realize up until this whole controversy bounced out is that DC actually offered Moore to give him Watchmen back. And he didn't want it.
There was more to it than them just offering it back to him.
He's basically, it sounds like he's just done with comics, you know, which, you know, fine. You know, if he's got nothing else he wants to do, so be it. And if Moore is not going to do anything with Watchmen and DC thinks they're going to make some money off it, let them. Watchmen is fictional. They are fictional characters. What DC does with Watchmen, with or without Alan Moore, with or without Gibbons, is their own thing. I mean, Watchmen in and of itself, it's almost like it's become art. I mean, it's almost a little dated in parts, but you know, I can reread Watchmen anytime I want, over and over, and get something almost new out of it every single time. I mean, the closest thing I've ever gotten to that is Astro City, where, and that's, you know, you go back and you reread bits of it and you suddenly realize, oh, that's the little string that makes sense farther down the road. But if, you know, they're DC's characters, you know, it's been how many years since Watchmen's come out? 20, 25?
Let's see. It ended in 87.
Okay, so about that.
It's about 23 years. No, now 25.
I've read up about all the creators who are working on this, and it sounds like they're very passionate about telling stories about characters.
Well, except for JMS, who I still don't think he'll finish the miniseries.
Well, we'll see what happens. But he actually...
Speaking of reading, I read his Fantastic Four run. I didn't realize he had abandoned it halfway through as well. And they had to bring in Dwayne McDuffie to clean it up and fix everything.
But on the plus side, 12 number 9 was in my pile this week, so we may see that end up finishing. But you basically what's happening is you've got, like what's happened with comics over and over, you've got a whole pile of creators who love Watchmen, and they're just chomping at the bit to grab these characters and try it themselves. Whether they succeed or not, we'll find out next year when we're probably talking about why is Before Watchmen the most expensive back issues in existence, or, hey, guess what I picked up in the quarter box? But to me, you know, they're fictional characters. They're owned by DC. Go for it. You know, I may pick it up. You know, again, it depends. Is it going to be $2.99, $3.99, $4.99? I'm curious as to some of the creators, what they're doing with it. And I'd like to see more of the characters. You know,
well, first, let's talk about Alan Moore. Mark Waid has been posting about this because he was working in editorial when Watchmen came out. I also have the comics, The Amazing Heroes and the Comics Interview, as well as some other Alan Moore stuff that has from the time. And at the time Watchmen came out, everybody talked about it was this great victory for creators' rights. And Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, both in their interview, said, we submitted this thing using the Carlton characters. And Dick Giordano, who was the person who kind of was the editor at Carlton when those characters were created, freaked out and said, you can't do these to my characters. So they went back, they reworked it, they created new characters, some of which are based on Carlton characters, some of which, you know, I'm sorry, Silk Spectre and Judo Master could not be less alike.
Yeah, and Comedian and Peacemaker, you could almost see you could put those characters in, but it wouldn't have the same effect.
Right, Night Owl seems more like an old fat Batman than an old fat Blue Beetle.
Yeah.
Dr. Manhattan and Captain Atom, next to nothing in common. No.
The closest they've ever done to make Captain Atom interesting is when he got split open in Kingdom Come.
Yeah. But the contract they wrote up was DC would publish the comic, and after the characters weren't used for a year, they would revert back to Moore and Gibbons. There were also things written in where any of the ancillary merchandising, movies, buttons, toys, anything that Gibbons and Moore would get a certain percentage of. And as things went on, you know, the book did very, very well. Partway through, they started soliciting things like a watch. You know, the Watchman watch.
Mm-hmm.
And buttons.
The buttons. Actually, I bought a button set for like $12. You know, these are like $50 yep. collector items, you know.
And Moore, as he's turning in the scripts, is like, well, when do I get my check for this? When do I get my check for those? And he was told by DC's marketing, no, those aren't ancillary items. Those are promotional tools. And Moore said, no, promotional tools are things that you give away to publicize. And it's written in the contract that promotional stuff would come out of this and that in return for me getting the money from the ancillary work. And DC stonewalled him on it. And people forget, at the time, Moore was actually working on a sequel to Crisis on Infinite Earths called Twilight of the Superheroes. By the end of Watchmen, things had broken down between Moore and DC over the fact that he didn't feel he was getting paid for the stuff he had done. Now, they already had deals in place for V for Vendetta. He'd already been working on Killing Joke. Killing Joke was actually supposed to be a Batman annual, But as the pages came in and Dark Knight did so well, they said, well, we need to publish this in a different format. The thing that killed it, though, was when DC announced that they were going to have, they were going to do ratings. You know, some things were going to be labeled all ages, some things were going to be teen, some things were going to be mature. And there were a number of creators who wrote an open letter, took an ad in the Comic Buyer's Guide saying, we do not agree with this, we think that labeling is wrong. Moore was one of them. Frank Miller was one of them. Miller, it was one of the things why Miller didn't work for DC for a while. Marv Wolfman put his name on it and was fired from his editor position. Now, he was mostly a writer-editor. He only edited his own stuff. But he was fired from his editorial position because he had signed this letter. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back for Moore. He said, nope, forget it. You guys, you don't have, you don't do creator-owned stuff. You reneged on your contract to me, and you fired this guy because he stood up for himself. That's it. I'm done with you. Moore had started his own publishing company called Mad Love. And that's where Big Numbers would come from. He was also really affiliated with Tundra, which was owned by one of the two guys from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So that's where Lost Girls and From Hell showed up in the anthology book Taboo, which was published through Tundra. But he just, Moore's one of these guys who, if he's not happy and he feels he's been screwed, he'll walk away. He walked away from Marvel when they started publishing the Captain Britain stuff in the U.S.
I thought Quesada took care of that.
Right, but we're talking in the 80s.
Okay, okay.
You know, when they started publishing the Captain Britain stuff in the U.S. and he didn't get a piece of it, that's when he said, I'm done with Marvel. Done. Absolutely want nothing to do with them anymore. The Marvel Man rights is actually what he called at the time the best way for creator-owned work to be done. His understanding was...
That turned out.
Well, that's because we won't get into that nightmare.
Yeah, that's a different... Well, we'll save that for a two-hour special. Better people than us have tried to figure this out.
Well, what it was supposed to be was Moore and the artist, Alan Davis, had the rights. When Davis left, his rights would then transfer to whoever the next artist was. Davis kept the rights to what he had drawn, but the rights to the character would pass on to the next artist. And Moore, when he was done, the rights would pass on to the next writer, which was Neil Gaiman. And that would go on down the line. That's what he wanted. Now, the problem is they didn't really have a contract set up for all of that. And then Eclipse went bankrupt, and Todd McFarlane came in and bought the rights to everything from Eclipse. And it's messy because Eclipse had a certain part of the rights for to be able to publish it. And that gives us the mess that we have now, and everybody's picking through and trying to fix it. And Marvel's actually spent a lot of money trying to get the rights all sorted out. But that is why Moore wanted nothing to do with DC. Paul Levitz had an agreement with him. It was a gentleman's agreement, much like the agreement they have with Neil Gaiman, where on Sandman, where no one will do a Sandman book unless DC goes to Gaiman and says, would it be okay if we use these characters from Sandman? And Gaiman usually says okay. I haven't heard of an instance of him saying no, but they go to him and they ask. With Moore, it was kind of the same thing. Levitz was squeezed out a few years ago. Dan DiDio comes in. He's told by Time Warner Brass, Watchmen's made a whole lot of money. We want more. We want more Watchmen. Now, DiDio knows what the original contract was, because it's still in effect. If they don't use the characters for a year, the rights revert back to Moore. Now, here's the thing that Moore says. They haven't used the characters. They just keep reprinting the book. They haven't used the characters. Characters have not been used. It should have reverted back to me years and years and years ago. So DiDio went to Moore. This is according to Alan Moore and also according to Mark Waid. DiDio went to Alan Moore and said, we will give you back the Watchmen, the rights to Watchmen. But first, we need you to put together a sequel or a prequel. And we want it to be this long, and we wanted to have it for this time, and here's a new contract, and we'll void the old contract, we'll give you the new contract, and things will pass over to you at a certain time. And Moore told them, there is no more story to Watchmen. It's done. If you go back to Moore's original interviews, about halfway through Watchmen, he was talking about maybe doing a 6-issue Minutemen miniseries. But by the end, he said, I've told everything I need to tell about the characters. You don't need to know anything more about the Minutemen than is already there. So DiDio went to Moore, said, we'll give you the rights back if you do more work for us. Moore, of course, doesn't want to work for DC because they've screwed him at every opportunity. They're using the characters he created, which in England he would have some say in, but here in the U.S. he doesn't. And he said, no, nope, I'm not going to work for you. You're not going to blackmail me into writing more Watchmen. F you, I'm done. And he's got enough money, he can do that. Now, for me, Watchmen's done. I feel the same way Alan Moore. The story's been told. I don't want to read 6 issues of The Comedian's Past because we know everything we need to know. I don't need 6 issues of Silk Spectre getting raped because we know everything we need to know. For all we know, what is it? I've got an interview up here with one of the DC brass who, let's see, well, there's a marketing plan in development for Before Watchmen. DC is already planning on how to market the collected edition to millions of readers who picked up the original Watchmen as a book, not a comic. Before Watchmen is not a one-time comics event. It is a plan to set in place something that is lasting. So if these sell well, guess what? You're going to get more. Maybe they'll do a 12-issue miniseries of the kid who is reading the pirate comic at the newsstand.
I think they already said that, didn't they?
I just don't care. It's the same thing like Jaws. Yeah, there are 3 sequels to Jaws. I don't care. Don't want to watch them. There's the Casablanca TV series. Didn't watch it when it came out. Joe, you're a huge fan of Casablanca. Did you watch it?
I wasn't aware of it. Although I did read...
With David Soul and Scatman Crothers?
No, I did read the sequel book as time goes on. And the first time I read it, I kind of put it aside because I didn't really get into it. And then a fan of it who really said, you know, you should probably give it another try because, you know, don't take it as, you know, this is Casablanca, but look at it as its own work. And I read it. And when I realized what the author was doing, where he was actually taking real world events and putting the Casablanca characters into it, it was an okay read. You know, I'm glad I picked it up for a couple bucks off eBay instead of paying $26.95 for the new one.
But, how about the book Scarlet, which was the sequel to Gone with the Wind?
Being that I don't really care about Gone with the Wind, that one didn't really bother me at all. Or even like when they redid, they had a guy come out and do Pogo or Nancy, you know,
yes.
The original creators passed away. You know. I don't know if the local paper carried it or not. I didn't really care. I never read Nancy with the original one.
Well, I remember this when they redid Pogo. And it was terrible, and it lasted less than a year.
Maybe that's why I don't recall it.
I am not one of these people who says DC's a horrible, horrible company for doing this. I hope that the creators make enough money that they make a living. I hope that the people who want to read it and enjoy it. DC has every right to do it. They screwed Alan Moore out of the rights to these characters. They have every right to exploit them however they want. I just don't care. There were novels made of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, that continues the story. They did like 8 or 9 novels. I've read about them. I have yet to read anyone who's said that they are anything other than just typing. Just like you're doing.
Yep. See, look at the whole
Watchmen. If it's not by the original creators, there are some things that are meant to be continued. Spider-Man was created as a series. Fantastic Four created as a series. Batman created as a series. Some things were meant to be just one story and done. And to me, all this before Watchmen stuff, it's like fan fiction.
Well, and that's like I said before, it might be fan fiction because you've got these professionals who are comic fans and they want to get a piece. Maybe they have a burning Watchmen story that they'd like to do. They might have seen these characters and go, man, I really got a couple Rorschach stories that just wouldn't work with any other character. You know, I always give it a wait and see. I mean, I don't take umbrage at the fact. I guess I don't buy the argument, you know, it's its own series. It's done in one. It doesn't need anything else. Because there may be somebody that can come along and outmore Alan Moore. We don't know. If he's never going to be given, or she, a chance, we'll never know. I will probably look at these just based on the names attached to them, because I'm kind of curious to see what they come with it. You know, I don't believe they should just be left alone. You know, it's... I can't for the life of me think of a Watchmen story I could come up with that would be worthwhile. Because I look at it, like you said, it's pretty much its own done in one, you know. But somebody may change my mind, come along with it. I used to look at comic characters, especially when they were outs. Like, I think I recall right after reading the Champion series, I had to just kill everybody. If I finished that series, because all the characters in there were just wastes. But later on, then Bob Layton came around and he made a Hercules miniseries that was actually quite fun. Simonson got a hold of X-Factor and turned Iceman and Angel, not the whole Archangel thing, but you know, they turned them into likable characters. So I'm always curious to see what other people would come up with. I know a lot of people are bashing Moore because, you know, I forget what he said when he's denouncing it, but they're bringing up the fact that a lot of Moore's works are basically not his original characters. He's taken already characters that exist, and he did that with Watchmen. And he, you know, instead of making Carlton characters, he made Watchmen. He took a bunch of public domain characters, made League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. You know, look what he did with Lost Girls. I'm sure there's a lot of people who have wonderful memories of Wendy from Peter Pan that wouldn't necessarily appreciate what he did. They would say the same thing. He didn't need to do it. It shouldn't have been done. I'm not interested in those series. Fine. I actually had a collector set sitting on my shelf. Apparently my college-bound daughter opened it and read it. So I keep telling her, don't open daddy's books until you know if they're worth money. So, you know, even Miracle Man, Swamp Thing, you know, everything Moore is done comic-wise, at least I should say for the big companies, Supreme, you know, it's always based on other things. Supreme allegedly is Superman stories that DC said no way, much to their, you know, idiocy, you know.
I've heard that argument too, and the problem I have with it is Moore is using characters that are just sitting out there that are public domain or he's asked to do things with, and he brings more to the table than he takes.
Well, that's what makes it sad.
He creates.
He's not doing comics anymore because I could.
Well, he's doing comics. He's just only doing the one. He's doing League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Or the Avatar stuff. He's giving them a short story and saying, here, do whatever you want with this. I wrote it so people can continue to play with it.
And see, I've always looked at Alan's ideas, you know, because he actually aped one that I've always thought of. All stories, and I think Grant Morrison's doing it with Batman. All stories happen. I look at it like, okay, every movie that I see, this actually happened. And then I shoehorn it into my reality that I'm living in, which was really fun when I got Inglourious Basterds.
That was even Jaws Revenge?
That's the way World War II ended. It's just not the way they teach it.
I think I'll stick with the Human Torch burned Hitler to a crisp.
Well, you know, there was a clone. There were some Hitler clones running around. So, you know. Anyways, but I, you know, like I said, I just want to see maybe someone's going to come up with a story using Watchmen characters that we're all going to sit back and go, wow, you know, he outmored Alan Moore. You know, I guess after watching the whole, you know, how the hell can Mr. Mom be Batman, you know, internet spasm.
Except there was no internet.
I just sit back and just see what happens. You know, if you're not interested, if you think there's no way anybody could do it better, I would, you know, do like Corey says. It's not for him. You know, I remember too at the, since we had Christy talk about her music, we'll add this as a mini tales from the shop. But I remember you coming out and you were just anti-Image. And it wasn't necessarily but the books they were doing, even though most of them are now in the quarter box. But it was just, they weren't doing what they said they were going to do. They said, we're making this a haven for creators to come in. The only thing they did different, you know, DC would pay you, Marvel would pay you X, and then give you your art back. Image kept your art, but they paid you about 3 to 4 times Marvel did. And that's how they got a lot of people to work for them. And that I believe part of it. you didn't buy this book until 1963 came out.
Right.
You know, and then it was, oh, see, everything you said is kind of invalidated because eventually somebody, in this case, Alan Moore, since we're talking about him, came to Image with something that caught your interest. It was just a matter of time until that happened.
But also,
happy birthday, Image, by the way.
Yeah, Image's 20th birthday. So the 20th anniversary book should be out in about 10 years. The other thing about it was Moore went to Image and said, if you're going to do, I want to do a book with you. I want to do blah, 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 blah. But you have to live up to what you said. The artists keep the rights to the, you know, I keep the right to the story. The artists get the rights to their art. We're going to tie in with your books, but we still own the rights to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There have been some people who say that because Moore won't finish it, the artists all got screwed, et cetera, et cetera. From what I hear, is it Veitch? He got the rights to his character from 1963. Moore said, oh, here you go. Signed off, gave him the rights to that character, and he may do more stories with it. The other artists have that opportunity as well. My problem with Image was twofold. One was it was the kind of superhero stories that I didn't like when Marvel and DC were doing them.
Oh, yeah.
But I also didn't like that they said, we're for creators' rights. Well, the only creators whose rights they were for were the 7 founders, and especially Rob Liefeld. He had this studio of people who were drawing his books. He would sign his name to them. They were given a flat page rate. If it was reprinted, they got nothing. Rob would sell the art saying that he drew it and he got all the money from that. So this creator's rights thing didn't happen. It wasn't until the big Image blow up where I think Top Cow moved out of Image and then Liefeld quit before he was fired. And then they looked and went, crap, we don't have enough books to be a Diamond premiere. So it was Jim Valentino who said, all right, we're going to publish these indie books where the people who create them own them. That's when they started appealing to people like me who didn't like the the Rob Liefeld superhero stuff, who didn't want yet another universe of bajillions of X-Men knockoffs, and the creators got to keep the rights. Going back to the Alan Moore thing, he was huge on creators' rights. His interviews at the time, he said, I want Image to succeed, but I want them to, you know, if you draw something, you get your name on it. If you create a character, you get to own it. And eventually they got to that point. But boy,
it took by necessity.
Yeah, it was by necessity. Another thing I keep hearing is, even as you say, well, Moore's not doing comics anymore. Well, he is doing comics. But he's working on specific ones. He's doing the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. He hasn't said he's not going to do comics anymore. He has said that he wants to focus on other things. And let's remember, the guy's in his late 50s, early 60s. I don't know exactly how old he is. He's got enough money to retire.
Oh, yeah. He's at the point where he can do what he wants.
If you look online, one of the more interesting videos I've seen lately, BBC took him to the Occupy movement in London. And he's talking with some of the people there, and they don't know who he is. They're all wearing V for Vendetta masks, and they don't know who Alan Moore is.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about the fact that he's very proud that he's kind of the godfather of this movement. But he points out the irony of the fact that every time somebody buys one of those masks, they're giving money to Time Warner, which is part of the 1%.
But I also think Alan Moore is kind of pleased that something that was made so cheap is being used to beat them over the head with it.
Yeah. So I don't – have they announced when these books start coming out? I think it's May.
I'll believe it when it's in previews.
Yeah. I think it's in the next previews. One of the other things that I think really ties into this that no one is drawing a comparison to, sales charts are coming out, and except for the top 5 or 6 books from DC, everything else is back down to the level it was before the new 52 or below. So that sales bump is just like the sales bump from 1 year later. It's gone.
Yeah.
I don't think they converted any of those people who came in for the number ones into new comic readers, unless they're buying them online or they're going to buy them as trades. DC has got to keep doing event after event after event after event. And they can't do another big universe crossover yet. So why not a Watchmen sequel? The other thing I'm worried about with this, and Joe, maybe this will hit you a little closer. They had a gentleman agreement with Alan Moore that they broke because, hey, we got to make some money. Do you think they're going to do the same thing to Neil Gaiman with Sandman? Could we be seeing Sandman books by Rob Liefeld?
It's hard to say because there's one difference between a lot of the pioneers and when you got to Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman didn't treat DC as a friend, as a confidant. He treated him as a business interest. And there may be things that Neil wrote into his contract that may preclude that, or it may just kick in. It's like, okay, you're Rob Liefeld, Sandman. You know, Neil might not have much to say about it, but he may get the money from it. I don't know. There's already stories where was an anniversary had come by, and Neil came up to DC and said, you know, I've got this storyline and this book that we could do for the anniversary. Here it is. And DC just plain said, no, we don't want to do it.
Which is weird.
Very.
Because, I'm sorry, Neil Gaiman writing a comic book.
And he was giving
book,
it to him. You know,
Gaiman writing a comic book is a license to print money.
I mean, if I was Time Warner and I'd heard that story, I'd have gone down to DC and said, okay, whoever came up with that brainstorm, pack your bags and go.
Yeah.
That's money on the table. That's the same thing I have with the fact that Marvel DC don't do their crossovers together anymore. That's money on the table. They're just leaving behind for the sake of egos.
And there's more to it than that.
That there could be. How long have we been talking? You want to talk about it or do you want to just save it?
Well, I'll talk about it a little bit. What it is, it's not just the egos, although right now there's a lot of ego involved because you've got the former Marvel editor-in-chief who was fired in charge of DC. And if you notice, more and more of the people who worked at Marvel in the 90s are popping up at DC writing books and drawing books. But by the time they ended doing the crossovers, they weren't selling that well. They were no longer top 10, top 20, top 25 books. They'd done so many of them that they weren't events anymore. Now, Avengers JLA, big event, sold really, really well. Matter of fact, the months it came out, it was the highest selling book. But those books only sold about 120,000 copies. And the amount of trouble and the amount of work and the amount of editorial, they almost, if not for the fact that they were able to print it in the big format, I forget what DC calls it, the omnibus, not the omnibus format.
Absolute.
Absolute format, before there was an absolute format. I read where it would have lost money if not for the absolute. Because Perez had a huge page rate. Busick had a huge page rate. You had almost 20 people in editorial working on it. It was horribly, horribly late. What a shock. It's a lot of work, and it's not a lot of return. Then add to that that there for quite a few years, Marvel didn't need DC. They didn't. DC was selling, you know, what it sold. Marvel was selling more using their own stuff, making their own events. I find it really interesting. We're 6 months into the DC 52. They're still selling more comics, but Marvel, even with fewer books, is making more money every month on regular monthly comics. And it won't be long. You know, there's a lot made of the fact that DC... What is it? Aquaman outsold everything that Marvel puts out. Well, you know what? Marvel's making more money. Now, DC makes up for it in the trades, but on regular monthly books, Marvel makes more money. So that's why you're not going to see any Marvel DC crossovers for a while.
And again, like I said, money on the table.
Not as much money as they think, though, because...
I think there would be, depending on how you do it. I mean, you gotta admit, Punisher Azrael, boring. You know, I mean, they did the one where, Galactus Darkseid by John Byrne. I just read that the other day. That was interesting enough. But I can't help but think, you know, if you could corral Kevin Smith and say, you know, produce that. Was it him that said they had a Daredevil Batman?
No, it's Brian Michael Bendis.
Oh, Brian Bendis. That would be even better.
And DC says that they won't work with Bendis.
And do you know why?
Dan DiDio doesn't like him on a personal level. At least that's what Bendis says.
And I would, if I was Time Warner, I'd come walking down, I'd smack him in the head and say, find someone who does like him and get it done. Assuming it's DC's turn to produce it. That's the type of crap. If I was a stockholder and if I was higher up, I would not stand for shenanigans like that.
Woo! You almost swore.
I almost did, but being that it actually won't affect me much, I guess I don't try to keep it PG. No, I guess I don't understand that. And you know, having owned two small businesses, if you got money on the table. You know, I had a guy come up when I used to run the stores and they're like, why are you selling candy? Because it sells. Because I make enough to pay the rent sometimes a month.
Yep.
You know, if it sells, it sells.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I would imagine that there's a curiosity factor and these books will sell well. I just think that 5 years, I don't think they're going to be the evergreens that DC thinks they're going to be. I think it's going to be like Butch and Sundance, the early years, where it comes out and if people go see it and they don't care, and now you can't even buy it on DVD. or how many other sequels and prequels have come out? The Sting 2. Well, we couldn't get Robert Redford, and so we got Jackie Gleason, and yeah, we got Jackie Gleason. Here's the Sting 2.
Well, Corey, you know, you just can't fix stupid, not even with duct tape.
Well, we've wasted over an hour of your life, and we finally had another great debate. This is going to be listed as a great debate, Joe.
A great debate?
Maybe we should have a debate over Hanna-Barbera characters.
I don't know. I wasn't really a Hanna-Barbera fan. I was more of a
Sid Marty Krofft fan.
Well, no, Warner Brothers first. Sid came later.
Our love of Charles Nelson Reilly. You know what new DVD set that I've been watching the past week or so on my overnights now that I'm done with Mad Men?
Lidsville?
Nope.
Match Game?
I have the Match Game DVD set.
I got that too.
Oh, the Charles Nelson Reilly stuff. The extras. One thing I will say, if you watch the extras on each disc, it's really weird because Brett Summers will talk about something and then they'll show the clip. And the clip is actually from somewhere else in the DVD. So there's this pause as the DVD player goes to where it is, plays it, and then it cuts off and goes back to her. But there's like 10 episodes on each disc, which it's really fun. Although I will warn people, if you're watching the disc, don't watch the early ones because they're not very funny.
Yeah, they just haven't gotten in there.
They weren't into the double entendre yet. Uh-huh. The questions were very straightforward. Whereas within about 3 to 6 months, they got into the more risque stuff. And boy. Most of the episodes on the DVD, you can tell that people are hammered.
The best way to do it.
I was watching one where the bit was that everybody on the top row had matched. So it's just the people on the bottom row. So Charles Nelson Reilly is out. Brett Summers is out. Richard Dawson decides he's going to do an impression of Brett Summers. And Betty White is going to do an impression of Charles Nelson Reilly. And Richard Dawson just goes after Brett on her drinking. He pauses all the time to take another drink and talk about how hammered he is. It's not related to comics, but it's related to Lidsville, which is related to what we talked about a couple times ago. So
and as we all know,
there you go.
It all comes back to Charles Nelson Reilly.
That's right. So you've wasted over an hour of us yammering on about funny books.
Did you say yammering or gammering?
Yammering.
Oh, okay.
How about gamera?
I don't yammer.
Because gamera is, you could get all the Gamera Mystery Science Theater 3000 DVDs now.
Gamera, good turtle.
Gamera is very neat. Gamera is made of turtle meat.
Oh, that's sweet.
And we like to remind you that the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic you like the most.